Are you ready to take your screenwriting career to the next level? If you're a new or aspiring screenwriter who feels lost or stuck in your career, the Working Writer School is here to teach you what writing courses don't.
Former student Dylan Evans said, "There are a ton of writing classes out there, but this course helped me work through the stuff that I couldn't find anywhere else. I feel more prepared and more knowledgeable to take on the next phase of my writing career."
Writer Nicole Bennett said, "After taking this course, I have a clear framework for the mindset, productivity, networking, and financial management skills needed for longevity in this industry."
And Jay Burlingham calls this course the map. "This course has given me a map that I will return to again and again as I move forward in my career as a writer."
Use code MMIH for 10% off from now until January 31st and go to theworkingwriter.com. That's theworking, W-E-R-K-I-N-G, writer.com to sign up today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. My first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, and Tubi.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in development on others. I'm making more. One of them is called Best Friends Forever. I'm also a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative.
This week, we welcome filmmaker and festival programmer Ashley Wessel on the show to talk about her life working at festivals and how that led into her life as a filmmaker and what she learned from watching so many movies. After that, we play a round of You're the Expert and we read an iTunes review. But first, an iTunes review. Oh my God, amazing. Liz, how are you doing?
I'm tired. I'm just tired. Yeah, you know, I'm tired. My son woke up, he had a bad dream, and then I was like, come into bed. Come, I will comfort you, little one. And that was a mistake, right? Like, we all know that you could tell. Like, you're like, this story is going downhill. Other than that, what is, well, I guess, a positive update is that I have a theatrical booker for my movie that hasn't been made yet. So that's, like, really cool, is that I wrote this article that got a good amount of attention for Filmmaker Magazine. I wrote it with Naomi McDougall-Jones. And a vendor of mine, a theatrical booker, wrote me and he's like, tell me about this disruption, this industry related disruption you are inspired to do for the next few years, which is what the article talks about. It talks about how filmmakers are not making any money and we have to set ourselves apart from this broken system. And turns out he likes disruption. And to him, disruption is like working with smaller exhibitors and unturning every stone and being really personal in his pitches with his films. And I was like, that's what I want to do. So he's on board. So it's going to help, I think, with pitches to investors for this film, again, that has not been made and has not been funded, to say it's self-distribution, but we already have a theatrical booker who's going to book the film for us around the country and possibly around the world. So that's my big update. And if anyone wants to hear more, they can follow us on Patreon, either the podcast or me individually, for Patreon supporters. Yeah.
The theatrical booker. So what do they do? They like just basically take your movie and help it get into theaters in a way where you profit from those bookings? Or are they just like getting you into the theater where you're paying for theater time? Or how does it work?
Well, we're going to be do straight bookings, but you're right. So there's different ways to engage a movie theater, right? You could four-wall, which is upfront payment, you reserve the space, and then all ticket sales come back to you. But what he and I are doing, his name is Henry Leistad of Sonder Entertainment. What he and I are doing is, we're doing straight bookings, which means we'll split the box office revenue with the theater, but there will be no upfront payment. And then what other benefits we get include, like, they market it, they may put it on the marquee. I could maybe put my movie poster in the front window of the theater. So it's like, and also I want to benefit movie theaters. I want to help keep them alive. Like, I want my efforts in marketing my film and making money to benefit them as well. So I'm more interested in straight bookings, and Henry's going to help us with that.
So that's harder, right? To get a straight booking than just, like, anyone will do a four wall, but doing a straight booking deal is, like, not something that a theater will take on for every movie.
Not if you're flexible. So I'm, like, incredibly flexible. So it's like, Tuesday afternoon sounds good. You know, it's like, what do you have free? What is available? Most likely we're doing one night engagements, not week long runs, so that we can make an event out of each of the screenings that we go to, or create some sort of added value. So, I mean, everything's difficult in distribution. I'm not going to say it's easy. I'm not going to try to paint it rosy. But this is all to say that not everyone is usually as flexible as I'm going to be. Like, I'm really right. just want to make as many bookings as possible to connect with as many audience members as possible.
Right. Because you can make an event of any screening time, basically, yeah. you know. And if it's a weeknight at like 7 or 8, better than, you know, Tuesday at 11.
Yeah. Well, and I think the idea is like whatever is their prime time for the latest Marvel film is we're not going to get those times. But right. do I resent that? No, because those Marvel films are keeping those movie theaters alive. So how right. can I come in at times that are less in demand and turn them into moments for us in the movie theater? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a lot of questions that you probably can't answer. Just about, like, you know, how interested are theaters in single night bookings? Like, are they more interested in trying to, like, fill a theater with a movie for a week? Or does it completely vary from theater to theater? This is probably a question for theater owners, not for you.
Well, a lot of art house exhibitors love indie film and genuinely want to support indie film and have to default. I mean, this is a real generalization, but have to default to tentpole films to stay alive. But I think we can make the assumption that they got into this business in this industry because they like bold new voices and outside the box films, and they want to be champions of cinema. So it's just about the right angle, right? So I can't say that all, because I'm focusing more on art house theaters. We may do a chain. We may pitch Landmark and Regal and AMC and all of those. But I'm more interested in, like, you know, the Roxy, you know, or like your movie theater in Oakland that you're obsessed with that you always talk about. What is that one called?
Oh, yeah. Grand Lake Theater.
Grand Lake Theater. Like these one-off, not necessarily always a multiplex, maybe a single screen theater, maybe just like two or three screen theaters. But these smaller houses that are almost like frozen moments in time, like they're just trying to protect that like cathedral space for moviegoers. And that's what I want to do, too, is like those older theaters.
Nice. Awesome. Well, in about 2 years, when you're at this point, I'm excited to see.
Jumping. I'm doing things a little early, but it might help us. It might help.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What's up? What's on your mind? Did you sleep? How are you?
I slept. My wife didn't really sleep very well. But yeah. She's also pregnant, so I feel like,
Hashtag pregnancy. It's like, does she have the leg cramps yet? Because I just started those.
Yeah, she has some leg stuff. Yeah,
those are fun.
But like she's also, you know, like she'll wake up because peeing, right?
Yeah.
Like she has to pee all the time. Yeah. And then sometimes it can be really hard for her to get back to sleep. So then, you know, and it's funny because like, well, anyways, it's a thing.
I live it. I totally understand. And I have no solution for her.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been taking care of my daughter for a week and a half almost now. And that's been really fun. But man, is it exhausting. Like I'll finish a day with her and I'm like more tired than working a 12-hour day, you know, working at my desk. You know, it's just like...
Because you care. Because you care about your child.
Yeah. Well, you know, we started gymnastics last week because I was like, I want to, with this time down, I was like, I want to do things. And so we've done 3 classes now. And man, it's just like, you know, you think it's hard, like a lot of work for her. Like, I got to run around and chase her or across this whole gym, you know? And like,
you can't just let her be with the teachers. Oh, because she's
really.
Too young.
She's okay, too young. Yeah. She won't listen to anybody. So like, she basically, like, they do like running back and forth in the beginning and then hop back and forth and then bear crawl or sidestep or whatever. She didn't know any of this stuff. She can't even go back and forth walking. Like she just wants to run around everywhere. And so like I'm like doing all those things with her and then we do stretches. And so like we do the stretches together where I'm like holding her legs. And so I was like, I'm doing all the stretches and all the running with her. So it's all full. And then there's like an obstacle course, you know, that she runs in the beginning. And so like I help her get through the obstacle. It's like, then I'm falling into the ball pit because she falls into the ball pit and I'm trying to get out of the ball. It's just craziness, man. But it's fun. But yeah, like yesterday, Monday, it was like 1 o'clock and I was exhausted, just dead. And I'm like, what is going on here? This is Monday. I should have energy.
No.
Anyways. Yeah. And I think I talked about the two things I'm doing on the side last week. You know, obviously our movie that we're working on together, mm-hmm. which is awesome. And then this other like little side post-production thing that I'm working on. I probably talked about that, right?
I think so, actually.
Yeah. I can't really talk much about it because, I would get in trouble, I think. I gotta, like, not say things. I was at a party over the weekend, and I was like, I'm working with so-and-so and so-and-so. And I was like, why did you say that? You're not supposed to be saying that. I mean, I didn't sign an NDA or anything, but still, it's, like, not really what I should be bragging about.
But you're proud. I don't know. I get it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, and no writing since we last talked. Boo, sad. And then the movie that I've been working on before, we're basically in talks with a production company who's going to partner with us now. And I guess it went well. It was a good first meeting, but they're making a movie right now. And so we're not going to have another meeting with them until like July. So yeah, we'll see you. See what that means and what happens comes from that meeting. You know, apparently they have some sort of lead to funding of some kind, but I don't know if they, you know, if our movie is something they want to take on or what or how the partnership would work. But, you know, it's nice that it's still got breath in it. It's still alive. It's not dead completely. Oh, and then somebody, I had the most wonderful thing happen to me a couple weeks ago. Somebody watched my movie randomly on Tubi, you know, and they sent me a script that they want me to direct. So it's the second time that's happened since the alternate's been out on Tubi. Like, I've gotten somebody reach out and want me to work with them. So that was like extremely warming and wonderful. Johnny, if you're listening, I see that's the other thing that's so brilliant about this. They're not podcast listeners. They don't know about the podcast. They just watched the movie and found me through that.
That's even more flattering. It's not the free PR.
it's not like because they listen to the podcast and they watch the movie. It's because they just found the movie and then they found me. So that was like, oh my God, amazing. So that's I'll be writing high off that for like a month or two. But yeah, that's what's going on. Nothing too exciting. But what is very exciting is our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. This is the way that the podcast keeps going, that it keeps chugging along despite Liz and I both having second children. The podcast will live because of Patreon. So thank you all for fingers crossed. Hey.
Oh my God, if we don't die of exhaustion, all
right. Yeah, right.
The caveat. Exactly.
Right. Death by exhaustion of being of parents. There's back episodes you can access to through our Patreon page. You can't get them anywhere else. I actually just took a whole big handful off last night. So episodes 300 to 350 are now gone. So if you want those episodes, that's the only way to listen. And then I took off the first 20. So the OG starter episodes are now unavailable. So if you're one of those people who like, hear this podcast, I want to know, how did this all get started? Well, now you can't do that unless you're a Patreon. So $1.99 will get you access to all that goodness. And yeah, I also wanted to say thank you to all the Patreon supporters because we're at our record high number. We have more supporters and more moolah coming in than we ever had before. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone for your support. It really feels great to see that number not going down like it has done traditionally. So thank you. Also, don't forget to check out Jambox.io. They're a new royalty-free music and sound effects company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese, and they even offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is pretty amazing. Use our code MMIH for a 20% discount on your yearly subscription. Without any more delay, here's our chat with Ashley Wessel. We are here with Ashley Wessel. Thanks so much for being on the show, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
Give us the elevator pitch for your short film, Weirdo.
Oh, man. I was unprepared for that. Well, Weirdo is a short film that's kind of like an origin story for a young man who I imagine will someday become a prolific serial killer, basically. That's love kind it. Of like the genesis of that. It's like an 8-minute short or something.
How many days did you shoot?
We shot One day, we actually shot back-to-back with the music video. So we used the same crew.
Oh, nice.
So we were in the same little town, just kind of like north of Toronto. Yeah. So we shot, it was like a relatively short day, actually. But we were already kind of there in this. We had the same home base as the music video and all this stuff. So, yeah.
What was the rough budget of the short, if you can say?
That one was $2,000 out of my own pocket. It was kind of like, also it was very like, hey, we're shooting a music video. And I was like, oh, then think about doing a short. So I like wrote it and was like, we're going to do it the same weekend. It's all going to come together. And we're going to like, I just basically put my, some of my fee for the video right back into the short. And it's just like, I haven't made, you know, when you haven't made something in so long and you're just like, do something, anything. And I'd had this idea for a while and I was joke that we got to do it. I love a creepy kid.
Well, speaking of that, what was the origin of the idea? Like, how did it come about? How were you inspired to write this project?
I really love, I'm like, in all of my projects, I tend to like a little more of like a gray area kind of character. Like, I don't love a, you know, a hero. I'm more of an anti-hero, and even more so in the sense I love almost like a villain who you're kind of on their side. And I love the idea that, and in this one too, I think because like the villain of the story is the bully that's kind of accosting this, the protagonist who is this kid. I like the sense of like, what's the chicken or the egg here? It's like, is this kid weird because he's put upon by this bully, or is this like, did this bully's abuse create this kid, or is this something else creating this kid and the bully can just sense it, or is it a little bit of a both that's creating this dynamic between them? I love that kind of like ethical gray area and moral gray area where we're like, do we cheer for anybody or nobody, or are we allowed to kind of cheer for parts of these people even though in the end they're all kind of broken and dangerous? I love that. I try to do that in all of my films, really.
How long do you spend working on the film from coming up with this idea to it being released?
Weirdo. I will, like, I don't know, coming up with the idea, it's like I have all these little floaty, whatever, it is in my head 5 years ago or whatever, who knows. I put it nonsensical notes in my iPhone notes that are make no sense. So I think it occurred as like one of those probably a year prior, but really, basically the moment we kind of knew we were going ahead with the video, I was like, here's this idea. It was kind of in the same vein, in the same neighborhood that we can shoot it. And I just kind of, I think I whipped up the script like a month beforehand and just kind of like powered through into it. This is, I never do that with any of my other work. So this one was like, it's kind of an outlier in that sense.
If you could change one thing about the film in any way, what would it be?
I think I would have given it a little bit longer. I would have gone through more note sessions on the script, because I tend to be a little bit, I lean towards more of like a vague, like, if you get it, you get it. If you don't get it, you don't get it, which I think doesn't come across that well. And I'm trying to like disabuse myself of that kind of instinct. So I think I would have gone through a few more note sessions and whatever, trying to whittle down the story so that what I'm trying to say really comes through a little bit more, and finding out a little bit more artistically what I would have liked to do, you know, with the camera work and stuff like that. Yeah, the usual.
I just want to hear a little bit about your philosophy around short films. Like, do you like have a goal for them? Like, when you make them, are you submitting them to film festivals? Are you putting them online immediately? Like, what's your approach when you make a short?
I always want to send them to film festivals, because film festivals are, I mean, it's, when you're making short films, I think you both know this very well, that like film festivals are, you know, where you meet A, other filmmakers, but also other people in the industry, people who are interested in, you know, maybe we want to work together later on, whatever. So it's like producers and like festival directors. Like, I actually meet a lot of people who work at film festivals at other film festivals. And like, when you create that relationship with people, you get your film seen by more people and you're able to have that outreach. And the more that happens, the greater your network is. So it's really huge for me to get them into film festivals first, and then to later have them online whenever their time may be, which for me is like in the next year or so.
I just want to add some additional context for listeners, in that you are not only just a filmmaker, and I say just a filmmaker in the way that like just a superhero, like just a filmmaker, but you're also a film festival programmer. And so what's really exciting is that you have a vantage point that not a lot of people have. So bringing that context into the next question, Oh, God, I'm just going to monologue, am I? Oh, yeah, I feel a monologue coming along. I always recommend to filmmakers to submit to film festivals because you never know who the screeners are going to become and who the programmers are going to become. And there's like this crazy back end world of networking that you have no control over, but just having your work screened is like an act of networking in a very bizarre way. I just be curious, like, do you submit to top tier film festivals for every film, or like, what is your philosophy of the value of the actual submission process?
That's a great question. I think, and like, it's a weird thing being like, especially with short films, because like, right, I do a $2,000 short film that is kind of like, has like, is vaguely genre. Do I want to spend $5,000 sending it into every top tier film festival, right? And it's like, I think my strategy tends to be, okay, here are the festivals that I've loved going to in the past, like ones that I felt like I got some kind of experience or relationships or whatever out of them. That's always gonna be the first ones that I aim to go to. So it's like, I mean, I've had great experiences with like, I mean, Horrible Imaginings. And like, there's one in Utah that's really like a crazy one that's like multiple days. And like, I've actually met so many people there. And so it's like, they're not top tier film festivals necessarily, but they have like a community around them. And so that's always something that I think is really important. But I also like, if I have like something that I feel like my film hit, I'll try to send it in to a Tribeca or like something like that. But I guess because minor genre, I tend to feel like that's not necessarily my audience anyways. And it is most like top tier film festivals, their kind of midnight sections or their like genre selections are so small that I'm like, do I want to spend the $50 for this? Or do I want to like go send it into Fantasia where I know that I have a chance and I still feel like I'm going to have that like top tier experience? So I guess that's my long-winded way of saying, like, I think the experience of going to a festival with a great community is number one for me. And then like, I will strategically send it to top tiers, but I never hold my breath. And like specifically for genre, it's a weird thing that I think you never really know where you're going to kind of come into view there. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Through your work as a programmer, like, do you feel like submitting to the top tier film festivals is really like kind of like a gamble? Like, unless you have a connection, like do you see it as sort of a real big kind of, like, just pie in the sky hope for like a small independent filmmaker? Or do you feel like you actually see movies where they like have no connections, like no nothing, like those movies are getting picked if they're good enough?
I think that actually does definitely happen. Like, I know I have friends who work for upper tier film festivals and stuff like that. And I know there is like, every programmer is different and every team is different. But like, I've had conversations with people where they do talk about how they have like this personal mandate of like, I want to find somebody who like needs my help. Like, who's like, there's a talent here and them coming into this film festival is going to be something big for them, but also for people who want to see their film kind of thing, right? So it's like, I think there's always a chance. I think absolutely, especially for short films, there's always a chance. There's always going to be those like bigger films that like you have to program just because it's like, it's the one, you know, like this season and somebody, you know, somebody higher up has decided this is the one. But like, small films always have a chance. It's a lower chance, but like, especially shorts, it's like, who knows? It's like a crapshoot. So I always try to like, especially with myself, I do a lot of research for film about the other film festivals and like, okay, what have they shown in the last 5 years, you know? And if it's nothing that's ever similar to anything that I've ever done and like they're not interested in my voice, then I'm probably not going to submit. But if I'm looking at a film festival and seeing like, who knows, it's like I feel like Sundance is very much like a, like, who the hell knows? Like,
especially lately, I feel like there's, the doors have opened just like the tiniest little bit.
Yeah. And with their genre selections, it's a big who the hell knows, I think, specifically. So with that, I think I will tend to, if I have something wackier that's going to surprise somebody, I'll probably kind of like see where I can go with it. But yeah, it's very, very strategic.
I hope this isn't an inappropriate question. When I was at Sundance, I was running a fellowship and I was trying to get people to submit to the fellowship, and they would be like, Sundance, they don't care about me. I'm not going to look. I'm not going to apply. Like, what's the point? You know, there was this, I think there's like a massive cynicism that permeates the world of indie filmmaking in terms of top tier artist support organizations actually discovering or supporting micro budget and lower budget filmmakers. I've also heard rumors about agents, managers, funders lobbying for films and festivals having to kind of bend to those whims. And it's all a rumor mill, right? Like, this is all like paranoia. So I guess my question, again, with way too much context and monologuing at you as per usual, is, are you able to share a perspective of seeing any sort of corruption at film festivals? Like, is it ever a fear of yours? Is it ever something that you've witnessed? Or have you been able to just really witness programmers be able to curate slates untethered by politics?
Like, some of the conversations I've had with people in the past, like, over the numerous years, I have to say that there's no question in my mind. There has to be, there's some lobbying going on 100%. There's just no question. It's happening. It's definitely happening. It's in every industry, people are bought and sold. Like, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, favors are traded, you know, that's going to happen everywhere. But I think every film festival too has different kind of like goals and what they want to be. Like, my experience with Horrible Imaginings, where I was programming, is like, I mean, I think we're a little bit, I don't know that we're different in whatever sense, but I know that the director, Miguel, he wants to bring kind of like, I don't know, I just want to say a socialism to like the genre world. It's like a weird way to put it, but kind of in the sense where it's like, there isn't like, you get in because you're this person. It's more like, and even like, sometimes the films that we would program weren't even like straight up like 100% genre or whatever. It was like, our mandate was kind of like, we want to, you know, bring these voices to the forefront, whether they're new, never been screened before. Like, we had a whole student section. Like, it was all about kind of like sharing these ideas with people that all kind of culminate in a singular vision for the festival. So it's like, I never experienced that. I can't imagine that it would have happened at Horrible Imagining, but I am 100% sure it happens at other festivals. There's no question.
For what it's worth, I also do festival lobbying. Like, I'm a filmmaker who's like afraid and paranoid of festival lobbying, but I've lobbied for my clients and I have 100% gotten films into film festivals just from an email. And it's pretty upsetting, but I've also got really excited that I succeeded at my job, but it's a corrupt. There's like a push and pull of success feelings there.
Yeah. I think everyone's been to like a top tier film festival and been like, this film is dumb and why am I watching it? And like, you're just like, obviously, it has the right people in it, it has the right people behind it, and that's just part of the industry. But it's like, if you're lobbying for like an indie film, I'm not going to be like, you're the man.
I know, they're like always really low budget films with like no cast. And like somehow that like the programmer just like wanted to rely on someone recommending something rather than watching like 20 more movies, which is lazy and corrupt as well. I just want to acknowledge like they're at fault too. But yes, the net good is a little bit different than like, you know, 42 West lobbying for some film that they made with Sundance. I don't know.
See, I would hope that they would talk to you about that, but then also continue to watch all the other movies.
I really hope so. But honestly, for this one festival I'm thinking of, I don't think they did.
Yeah, I think a lot of festivals did do that. I know our festival is like, we watched to the end of the credits every single movie. It was like, wow. Hardcore. Like, it was one of the main things that we were like, this is what we do. So yeah, I've seen a lot of long credits in my life.
So how did you get involved in programming in the first place? Like, what led you to that path? Like, were you a filmmaker first and then programming, or did you programming and then become a filmmaker? Like, how did it play out?
I was a filmmaker first. My first short, it was like making the rounds, whatever. And then, no, I can't remember if it was on my second short or my first short. Oh yeah, it was on the round for my first short. And I actually randomly, I was at a film festival and I met Miguel. You like meet random people at film festivals. That's how you do it. I was just like, you're the best person on earth. And then I told him that I submitted my film to a festival and he rejected me. And of course he like felt so terrible, but I was like, no, I completely understand. It's fine. Like, that's your job. If you don't think it works, it doesn't work. But then like we met then and he got in touch with me, I think later that year or soon after, and was just like, the way that he built his programmers is like, we're from everything. There's like actors, filmmakers, journalists, like every neck of the woods. Like I'm in Canada, somebody's in France, like we're all over the place. So I think he was just like, you have an interesting point of view. And I think you have a lot to say about films. And he wanted us to all have very disparate points of view so that we could kind of bring different points of view to the selection process. So I actually started programming because of going to film festivals with my film.
I have another question about lobbying and then I probably will shut up. I'm just so interested in festival lobbying. I have a lot of clients who write these really dense personal cover letters that they sent through Film Freeway. And my presumption is that they're absolutely never read. And I would be curious, you don't have to say for yourself, but do you know if programmers ever read cover letters?
I will say that I do, but I don't think everybody does. I have like a thing of like, I have like my depths that I go through. So like open it up, watch the film, and then I will look at the cover letter. And then I will look at the kind of like filmmaker's info. And sometimes, because like the thing is, like, I think it's really important for a film to stand on its own. And there's a lot of filmmakers that will send their film in and then explain what it means in the cover letter. And you're like, I did not get that in the film. And I'm sure I've been guilty of this myself. But it's like, if I don't get it from the film, then I can't really be like, we can't give everyone a cover letter before we screen the film in the block, right? So it's like, as much as I'm like, that's a great idea, and I'm really glad that I know now what that meant, it's not necessarily going to change how I feel about the film. And sometimes it changes it negatively, because then I'm like, I really didn't get that. I thought it was something totally different, and maybe I don't like that idea. But in the end, it's always just about the film. It's like, is this film standing alone on itself, regardless of who the filmmaker is? And what they say about it. But I like to know. And I think it gives me some context sometimes to even know who the filmmaker is. And like, sometimes I'm like, oh, this person's from like Germany and this is all English. And you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you're like, oh, well, like I'm kind of more impressed now knowing who you are. Yeah. But I always read it. I think it's important to give people that time.
You're a good egg. That's why.
I have a couple of questions about cover letters. Like, first off, do you prefer a shorter one, longer one? Does it matter at all? Like, is there any preference there? And then is there anything that someone could write in a cover letter that would turn you off of their movie after you've watched it? Or is that like not really a thing?
I think cover letters, it depends on what you have to say. Right? So like, I've had cover letters where people are like, hey, Miguel, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, this person obviously knows like people who work at a festival and they have a lot to say to them. And it's really sweet and great. And I've had other people who are like, here's like a 20-minute cover letter. And I'm like talking about nothing. And you know what I mean? Like it can get a little bit, sometimes people get a little bit, you know, I've won this many awards and I'm this and I'm that. And I'm like, nobody cares about that right now. What we care about is your film. It's fine. Calm down. So it's like, I think, and sometimes a short and sweet one, just being like, hey, I'm really proud of this movie. Like, I'm really excited to send it in, blah, blah, blah. Like a nice short, just kind of like, hey, what's up? This is me, can go a long way. And I shouldn't even say it can go a long way, because it really, for me, doesn't affect how I feel about film. However, if somebody does send a nice cover letter, sometimes you're like, it'd be fun to have this person at the festival. You know, even have somebody like involved in that. And that is part of that film community and whatever. And it wouldn't necessarily change my mind about it, but it might make me just be like, hey, look at this. Like I'll send it up the, you know, flagpole and be like, this person seems rad. And like, I think that does affect what the environment is later on. So I think it does do something. And in terms of, I don't think if their cover letter was really awful, like if somebody said something like misogynistic in it, I might be like, that has never happened, thank goodness. But I have to be honest about my own biases. Like I might just be like, red flag them just out of, I don't want to be near you. But that's never happened and probably never will. I try to keep that, what they say, apart from what their film is as well as I can. I'm only human.
I work in sales, right? I work in distribution and I pitch films to distributors. And very often, if it's an indie film, no cast, maybe no genre, festivals are incredibly important. I'm unsure if festival programmers are aware of how bottlenecked the curation of the entire industry is on what you do. Like, I think there's a lot of distributors who don't screen films and will just rely on laurels as like someone who pre-vetted the work. Do you feel that pressure? Like, do you feel like when you're making a decision to pick a movie that you're essentially opening a gate for someone or breaking down a door? Like, does it feel like you're handing an opportunity to someone, or do you look at it as just this small decision? Does it feel big or small to you?
It depends on kind of the context of, like, when I was screening like student films for like the student film block, it felt bigger to me in a weird way, where I'm just like, this is like a 17-year-old kid who's like, take my first baby world. And I think in rather than me, like my saying yes being something that's really important, I feel like me saying no, I don't want to be a part of like giving them a bad feeling about themselves, or like, you know, kind of like, I don't want to make them afraid to try again. You know what I mean? So I think, to be fair, like with our student films, like we'd make notes, but we wouldn't ever red flag it. And it kind of always went up to higher levels. But in terms, because we're such a small festival, I think I felt a little freer with like, you know, more established filmmakers to be yes or no, just because it was more about how to create this cohesive festival than it was about kind of like success for filmmakers, because I really don't think anyone's coming in and being like, well, we got into Horrible Imaginings. Like,
they do, by the way. They do, like, yeah, like that is like a thing where if I were pitching a distributor, it would be one of the festivals I would be listing.
Oh, that's nice.
So for what it's worth.
I just, because like I know as a filmmaker, like the bigger festivals I've gotten kind of feet off of that in terms of like, you know, managers and agents and stuff like that. And distro as well. But I've never gotten anything coming up to me from smaller festivals. So I just kind of always assumed, I'm like, this is for the festival. This is for like creating this like experience for the filmmakers, and hopefully like I'm able to bring in some new voices who have something really interesting to say. Yeah. And that's kind of like, I thought as far as I got with it. I always feel bad saying no to people, but I never felt like my yes was that important, I guess.
Yeah. I wanted to hear a little bit about like what you've taken from your film festival experience, like, and how that's affected you as a filmmaker. Like, has it changed any way that you approach your art, or is it kind of like you just now know more, so like you're more informed on like where to, you know, try to send a film or something?
It has like changed my filmmaking a lot. Mostly one of the biggest things is like, did you have to watch like a million films? So it's just like, first of all, my first season of Horrible Imaginings, Miguel kind of like randomly assigned us all kind of like, okay, you get this chunk, you get this chunk, you get this chunk of whatever. And we all got a certain number of features and like just like a certain number of shorts. My first round, I think I had something like 30 shorts, and all of them were 20 to 40 minutes. And
I was like, no.
I was like, what did you do? He's like, this is all accidental. And I walked off. And I was just like, I'm never making a short over 10 minutes ever again. Like, it was so insane. And it was another reason for that. It was like, there were a few in there that I was like, this is fucking gold. Like, this is the best short I've seen all year. And we couldn't screen it because it was so long that we would have had to cut like five other shorts. And it's just like, knowing that, I'm like, that for one, if I'm making any short films, I would never do that, knowing. But like before that, I didn't realize how detrimental that would be, and how it's like, even if somebody absolutely loves it and like wants to fight for it, there just isn't space sometimes. That, and like, just, I didn't, there's a lot of like ideas that I've had where I'm like, this is great and fresh and awesome. And then I see like 15 shorts that year that were the exact same idea. And I was like, oh, okay. So I started to understand what's kind of a little bit tropey and what stuff like that. So I'm like, I guess it's given me a better perspective on how to bring like something new to the table. It's like, I know I have to go kind of way outside the bounds and like find something that's really unique to my experience, or to something that I love that I can say something about, because just having a fun concept is not gonna necessarily be enough, because like 30 other people might have the same idea, like might have the same log line, for example, you know, and it's just like, you gotta do better than that.
Were they all cannibalism movies? Was it all cannibalism? Is that what it was?
There was a lot of cannibalism.
I know. It's
so
weird.
So many, and I don't know why. Cannibalism and zombies. God, the zombies. So many zombies. There's so many. And there's so many where it was like, literally, I was like, I would have an idea and be like, this is dopest. Like, this is so unique. And like, just like, oh no, that's out there. Like, there's a lot. Nowadays, there's a lot of women, lots of guys doing like women as the like.
Strong, powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. Like kind of, it's like reversing tropes, but because so many people are doing it now, I'm kind of like, okay, I got to try and see. Like, it's just, it goes in waves, right? Everyone finds like, and you don't realize that you're kind of, because of the zeitgeist, like it's all being put into our heads and it kind of is rattling around 100 different people's heads and it's all coming out. So it's like, I got to keep my ear to the ground. And I think, again, and I think this is what happened with my first short, is like, there's other films that had similar vibes to mine, and that's why mine didn't get in. And it's like, if you don't kind of keep it fresh and personal and a little bit more off the beaten path, you might not even get the chance to get into that festival. So yeah,
is that really the answer? Like, to keep things fresh, keep it personal, like, because that seems to be the best way, because no one's you, right? Like, you could have an idea, but no one's going to be the person you are. So I don't know. And any other things you can think of to like keep something fresh and avoid that same problem?
I think part of it is like, because they always say write what you know, and I mean, that's like such a hard thing to put into practice until you realize like, okay, what I know is maybe just like, you know, I mean, being a genre filmmaker, I'm like, my second short's about vampires and my first one's about somebody being impregnated by a monster. Like, so it's like, okay, this is not what I know, clearly. But it's like, I know what my point of view is on things, and I know, and like, if you can put your personal moments in there and your personal experiences and really like find something that's like kind of outlandish and something that people aren't talking about in the same way maybe that you would be able to talk about it. I think those are the films that pop up where I'm just like, this is awesome. Like, something that you don't expect, but you see somebody's personality in, is, it's hard to nail down because every single one is going to be different for like, everyone is telling a different story for a different reason in a different way. But if you've got that, like, you know, unique aesthetic where, whether you treat sound or image differently from everybody else, or whether it's a story about something that people have never heard, or whether it's just like a relatable story told in a unique way, everybody's got that in them to do it. You just kind of have to be like, maybe I'm not going to do the zombie movie like that episode of The Walking Dead. Maybe I can do zombies, but it has to be, you know, maybe it's in my hometown, or maybe it's like my dog is the star or whatever. Like, there's always something. There's always a way.
We have to talk about Junction Row, your first feature, and how that came about. Like, how, yeah, just tell us, how did it happen?
That is another kind of a film festival thing. So I did a feature script for my second short, Tick, and I was pitching it at Frontiers, which is like a co-production market at Fantasia. And I met, at that point, they were doing sales and distro, one of the guys from Raven Banner Entertainment. And I feel like that was like 2 years before whatever. And I had met him again, I think, at another event. And then he literally like added me on LinkedIn and like kind of was like, hey, can we talk? And I was like, sure. And they were looking to get somebody on board for a script that they'd had in development for a couple of years, maybe it was a year. And they were looking to go into, like, this was in like June of 2021. And they were like, we want to go into camera in September. And I was like, wow, all right. Like, it's like a sci-fi horror, which is like my jam. So I couldn't really say no. And yeah, we kind of like, it was very, very fast. And we ended up shooting in December.
Wow.
Yeah, it was wild.
So I have so many questions. So that was your first feature. And you got hired to direct it.
Yeah, I was a director for hire on that.
And amazing. Can you talk about like how that played out? Like, did you get to have a say in casting? Did you get to have a say in bringing on your crew? Like, what kind of freedom do they give you in that role?
I'm the kind of person that I just assumed I would have a say in everything. I didn't even ask. I was just like, great, casting, here's who I want.
Yeah.
Like, they were like, oh, okay, well, I mean, like with anything, because it wasn't my project, I wasn't producing, I'm very opinionated. So I was like, I want this, I want that. Like, this is exactly how I'd like it to go. And other people had other ideas. And of course, we kind of, it was also one of those, because it was such a short period of time, it was like, well, okay, well, this person's in Japan. And you're like, well, damn it. So you kind of like, it was a back and forth, and we found a lot of really talented, it was specifically Canadian actors too, because we had, it was like grants to kind of fulfill and stuff like that. So it was very, very fast in casting. One of our actors we cast like the week before, like we went to camera.
Wow.
And it was just such a weird, like, you, with casting, and I'm sure you guys have gone through this, it's just like, you know, when you're like, you send something out and you're just like, okay guys, time is ticking, and like they're just not getting back to you. So there's a lot of that. But yeah, they let me be a part of the casting. And crewing was really rough because it was actually like nobody was around. Like people were like, everybody was shooting, everybody was like scrambling to shoot. So there was like very little crew in, like, who were available. Like September in Toronto is pretty crazy. So when we started getting everything together, it was a little bit wild. So we had a very young crew, but we ended up getting like a good solid crew together, and just like, let's go to Northern Ontario this December. Yay. So I don't know if it was my experience was the same as other people's in terms of that, but I just kind of was like, yes. So here, let's do this together. I've decided I'm a part of everything.
Not that you should have imposter syndrome, but I just am confounded always by confidence. So this is, it's not you. I'm just asking everyone this question, which is like, in transitioning from shorts to features, was there any fear? Was there any anxiety? It sounds like you were like, let's do this. It sounds like there's just a lot of enthusiasm. I'm just curious if you maybe are jumping over or maybe forgetting any parts that were really scary in that quick transition over.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a weird thing because like I had just been working on writing a feature with a friend of mine. So I'd actually gone through a lot of like that imposter syndrome for the last previous year because like we were like trying to get greenlit by like a pretty big kind of like body that would, you know, if we could get this moving, yeah. But so it was a lot of like, oh yeah, people are reading my work and like, what am I even doing here? Why is anyone talking to me? I think I'd kind of gotten used to that feeling for the year before that. So when I did this, I was like, yes, somebody's saying yes to me. Let's do this. Like, I have no, like, can't, I won't stop. Let's go. So yeah, like, I think imposter syndrome is like just a part of my DNA now. And I've learned to just live with it. So I'm just like, and I think my response to feeling like I'm not good enough and why am I here and all that stuff is to just be like, you know, my terrible metaphor that I'm about to, that I've never used before is like, if I was like, I tied it around my waist and it was like a rock, instead of being like, oh no, I have to drag my rock, I would just be like, well, the faster I go, the faster the rock will come behind me. So it's like, I just run forward, like run towards the danger kind of thing. And it works pretty well for me because then you get all like into it and you kind of forget to second guess yourself, especially when you're on set and you're doing it, right? So it's like, yeah, I think I get a lot more of that in the writing process, but in the directing process, I'm just like, well, I'm here. Like, give me 9 coffees and let's get going.
So I did a little quick research, and IMDb Pro says the movie's budget is around $3 million, so I don't know how accurate that is. But like, going from like working on short films, like especially like your last one, $2,000, to being on a set, like even close to that or around that budget, like what was the difference? Like, did you feel like empowered? Like, did you have all the tools you could ever need? Did you have more time? Or was it kind of like, oh, you know, it's just another version of the same thing with more people?
I don't even know if that's accurate, if I'm being honest. I saw that on the TV show and I was like, I don't know. At the start, I don't think that was our budget. I think that we've added more for post. Basically, it was such a crazy, because like the initial concept for the initial script is like, a lot of people involved in it. It's like this kind of an underground community. So it's like, we need these like background, and it's kind of like, I wouldn't call it an ensemble cast, but there's a lot of like speaking cast members who kind of like had, it was a lot of moving pieces. So really it never felt like we had enough. And I think no matter what the level of the budget is for anything though, it never feels like you have enough. Cause then no matter what you do, you're going to oh, I have $5,000. Well, let's stretch it till it feels like we have $7,000. And then everyone's hair is on fire the whole time anyways. So yeah, it's always felt chaotic and never felt like we had enough money. But that's just how it works, I think. And also we were in basically like a perpetual snowstorm.
Wow. Last follow-up question on that. How many days did you shoot? I'm just really curious.
We did 18 days proper. Wow. And then we had like a 3-hour splinter day in the city.
Wow.
Yeah. So
crazy.
Yeah, it was pretty tight.
I think it's time for our final 6 questions. So brace yourself, Ashley. First question, what's the first film you've ever made? Take that for however you want to interpret it. And how do you feel about it now?
My first film I ever made was Ink, which is, it wasn't that long ago, honestly. It was like 2016 or something. I'm like, that's all right. It's there's zero dialogue. I had no idea what I was doing. And I just kind of was like, did what I could with what I had. And I think it looks like a lot more than I had. So that's good. Yeah, I'm proud of it. I've gotten over hating it. And now I'm like, yeah, I did that.
What's the best filmmaking advice that you've ever received?
Ah, that's a tough one. So much good advice. I think for me, and I don't even know that it was filmmaking advice, but more like, even this has to do with the whole imposter syndrome thing, is somebody told me that you have to have a sense of destiny to be a filmmaker. Like, you have to feel like you belong there, and like, what else are you going to do with your life? Or else you're just going to be like, well, I could be an accountant or whatever. And I think that's when somebody said that, I was like, you know what? Like, I think that that's how I realized, like, maybe I could do this. Cause like, that's all I want to do. And that it feels like it's my destiny. And like, hey, I'm going to ride that. So it's helped me to not second guess myself so much.
Oh, I truly love that. All right. What's some bad advice you were given? I mean, it's the question is what's the worst, but like, that's a tall order.
Oh my God.
What's some bad stuff?
What's the worst advice? God, now there's a lot of that. I think in terms of like being on set, I've had people be like, you know what, this isn't important. The details aren't important. You just have to get it done and you can like think about it later. I was like, are you seriously saying this to me right now? I'm a very detail oriented person. And I think some people think that it's a little bit like I overthink things, which I'm sure I do sometimes, but I'm like, for me, that's just wild and crazy. It's like that kind of filmmaking is like, you know, some people don't make shot lists. Some people don't make storyboards, things like that. And I'm like, no, I'm such a planner. So I'm like, that to me, that's the worst filmmaking advice I could ever get, is to just like try to figure it out later. No, thank you.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Fix it in post. Oh, yeah. God, the worst.
Yeah.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
I mean, I'm in the space where really I'm kind of on the cusp of like, you know, being a career filmmaker. I hope I have like, it's like a bit of a dichotomy where it's like, part of me is like, I want to be a career filmmaker. I'm going to go do TV and blah, 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 blah. But then part of me is also like, I'm really invested in making feature projects and narrative projects that I really believe in and that are exciting to me and are something that only I can say. And so I think what I'd love to do is be able to kind of balance both of those worlds where it's like, hey, I can feed myself and pay my mortgage. And also here's something that I love that I will like lovingly bring to everybody and hope that they will love it too.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
I think if I go back to when I was 17, I would say, don't go to university for theater, go for film like you want to, because you can do it. Because back then I never would have believed that I could do it, because it was like for old guys with baseball hats on. Like, but now I'm like, oh, I know I can do it. And I would have told myself back then that I was allowed to do it. And I was allowed to believe that I could be good at something like that.
Last question, is making movies hard?
The question. It is both the hardest thing that I've ever done and also the only thing that I ever want to do again. There you have it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Where should people go if they want to find out more about you? Where should they go if they want to see your shorts? Like, if they want to support Junction Row, what should people do?
Well, soon. Junction Row will be out and finished, hopefully. I hope that it will be in film festivals. So you'll be able to find out about that on my Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. All of it is at Ashley Wessel, A-S-H-L-E-A-W-E-S-S-E-L. Or you could go to my website, which is also ashleywessel.com. Ashley with an A and not a Y. Me. And all of my shorts are, I have two of my shorts are on Alter right now on YouTube. Or you can go to my Vimeo, which is Ashley Wessel.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show! Liz, what do you remember about our talk with Ashley?
She's cool. Like, she just had like a great attitude. That's what I remember. And even in the like scheduling process of like figuring out when to get her on the show, I've never seen anyone do this before. But like, she commented on the calendar hold, like looking forward or excited or so. I just think I have this feeling that it's not just us, Ulrich, that is something that she permeates her entire life with. Is that a phrase? That she, God, sleep is so helpful in finding words, but it's just not there.
I like the idea of positivity and like, you know, enthusiasm being something that you can permeate your life with.
There we go. Okay. I'm going with it. I should become a poet. I should just never sleep and become a poet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that I connected with Ashley, which I don't talk about on the show, is I applied to a film festival. We mentioned it in the show, but that film festival had a moratorium this year. And Ashley kind of took over as the contact person and mentioned that she listened to our show. And I don't know if you feel this way. I think you do. But it's like, I always want to talk to festival programmers. Like, it is like, oh, yeah, so interesting to me. And so I took that opportunity to be like, oh, door is open. Let me pounce on you and see if you could come on the show. And I just loved the conversation with her. So that I just remember only positive things. What do you remember?
Same. I just remember it was hearing about her approach, you know, as a festival programmer and like what she does when she's screening movies and her whole philosophy about working at festivals and her experience getting into festival work. I thought was all interesting. And then how that directly led into her, you know, world as a filmmaker and like taking like those experiences in festivals into her filmmaking. I thought that was really fascinating and interesting. And she's just a delight. What a wonderful conversation. Just, I could have talked to her for another hour easy.
Me too. But now is the time for our second or first favorite segment, depending on how you feel that day. It's called You're the Expert. You're the Expert is handmade by Eric Toms, our producer. And Eric has decided that we're experts in our field of indie filmmaking, and he wants to ask us advice and have us dispense that advice. Oh, my Lord, where is my brain? And that's what we're doing right now. We're going to give that aforementioned advice. So his question for this week is, should I sell physical copies of my film? So, Ulrich, what do you think? I think I know your answer because you talk about it every show, but go on.
I don't know. I guess I don't know because we have the movie on Amazon to be able to, you know, buy as a physical DVD. And I was just trying to see how many sales we've made of it, but it's extremely low. I don't even think I have the exact numbers, but it's not a lot. And I gauge that from the one review that we have on it. It's a very, very low number. But yeah, I don't know. I would like to sell physical copies of my movies. I just don't think that like the times I've done it, it hasn't really been like a big push. Like I had, you know, DVDs of my first short film, Strange Thing, that I made for my Kickstarter. I still have like a handful of those sitting in a closet somewhere, you know, and they're like never gonna be sold to anyone. I mean, I think like a few of them got, you know, given away or whatever, but like no one's buying those, you know. And then the alternate, yeah, I mean, I feel like people are watching it mainly on Tubi. That's like the most attraction I think we get is Tubi and maybe some iTunes and Apple and stuff, but like I think most people are watching it on Tubi and like certainly not downloading or going out to search and find the, you know, the DVD that has a bunch of special features and commentary tracks on it, which I was like really passionate to make because I love that stuff. But yeah, I really don't think many people have that. If you have that, if you bought it on Amazon, I'd love to know. Call in. Let me know that you're one of the few who have. I don't even have a copy. They're supposed to send us like 10 copies. I don't even have one. Yeah, that's. I don't know. I wish it was a good idea, but I don't think it is. What about you, Liz?
I think people should do it, but I don't think they should do it expecting lots of money. So I was looking at, for my first feature, Bread and Butter, I was like looking at all the things we did. So we did a commentary track. We included our trailer. We included interviews and reviews. I had something about the music of Bread and Butter. I had the audition videos. I had deleted scenes. And then our lead actress, Christine Weatherup's sister, Jenny Weatherup, is a really good artist. And I commissioned her to do a coloring book page, which I included in every single copy of the DVD or Blu-ray. And we self-distributed physical distribution, DVD or Blu-ray. Me and my editor, Bruce Novotny, he had a DVD and Blu-ray burner and disc art printer, and we did it all ourselves. We did not make a ton of money, but I'm really proud of it for archival purposes. Like, I'm really proud of that we learned how to do it, that we made the effort, that we added so much value. For my second feature, yeah, we didn't do anything and we probably made the same amount of money. But in distribution in general, the way people talk in my world is that they say physical distribution still exists. That's what they call DVDs and Blu-rays, is physical distribution still exists for documentaries and horror. Because it's the idea either it's an older audience or it's a collector audience. And I would say if you're doing conventions or conferences or, and that both happen in the horror world and in the documentary world, then you want merch. And the obvious merch is physical discs. But if you're not doing that and you're not going to market it and you don't want to archive anything and it's just going to be this thing that you just hope collects passive income, no, like it's not necessarily worth it, right? But the goal is that when you make a movie that you're actually marketing every single effort and every single window for the film. So I also think since I never back up my hard drive, I'm like knocking on every piece of wood of our place right now. Like, I always think, well, at least I have the DVD. Like, worst comes to worst, my drive fails, I have something. Like, my distributor goes bankrupt and, you know, their archive sets on fire and there's no, you know, record on the cloud somewhere. Like, at least I have a DVD or a Blu-ray of the film. So I like knowing that. It makes me feel better.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. Well, I can't even find the movie on Amazon anymore to buy as a DVD. It's not even listed. So that's not good.
No.
Makes me not happy. I can see it to rent. But yeah, not to buy
anymore.
Maybe
you need to write a little letter to someone.
Yeah, I think I do. I need to write a letter to my distributor. Like, what the hell? You said I could buy my movie would be available on Amazon, and now it is not available on Amazon. What is going on here, people?
What happened? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to know what everyone else thinks. Like, have you had a super duper success selling physical copies of your movies? I know Alex Ferrari would say he did. I don't know if you've heard the Alex Ferrari story of selling short films on DVD and making his budget back and whatnot. Yada, yada, yada. So, no? Okay. Anyways, that's a story. That's a thing. He talks about it when he was first on our show. Anyways, yeah, I feel like it definitely is a thing, but I don't know if it's the thing that's going to bring you a ton of money. But I will double down on what you said, Liz, about that if you're doing conventions. Because, like, if you are going to be doing conventions and going out there and getting in front of people, like, yeah, the first thing I'm going to want to do is buy your movie.
Yeah.
If I run across you at a convention, I'd be like, yes, let me buy a copy. I will support you in that way, and I'll have all the special features, and that'll make me happy, you know? So.
Oh, wait. I know you're twitchy topics, but let me just look up something really quickly on Twitter because it's very interesting. Sorry.
Sure.
I just interrupted you. Hold on. And then there's just going to be this lull for Jeff to take out now that I've interrupted without it being ready. So there's this tweet by Kate Hagen on Twitter on the 18th of April. And it said, at this moment, Netflix is streaming about 3,800 films, less than half of what the average blockbuster used to carry. As for films made before 1990, only 79 titles are currently streaming. If we go to 1980 or earlier, that drops to 36. And her takeaway was physical media still matters. So it's like, think about all the things that are going to either be taken away from streamers or have limited licensing periods or whatever. And like, think optimistically, people could feel that way about your film and they want to have some sort of something permanent and some sort of reflection of your work. And you could be your film could be someone's favorite movie, right? And it may not be on iTunes forever. So I just thought of that other reason is like, have them made if you can afford it, if you're not expecting, if you don't have unrealistic expectations, have them made because physical media does matter. It does matter because streamers should not decide what should be watched and what shouldn't be watched. They shouldn't have that all that power.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go on to something that we don't always get to do, but we get to do today, which is read an iTunes review. Oh my God, this is amazing. I wrote wahoo in the outline, which I think is definitely how I feel inside for sure. Anyways, here we go. Best podcast for indie filmmakers. This is from M.K. Bryce from the United States. I'm a screenwriter with my first feature currently in post-production, and this podcast is a godsend. It makes me feel like I'm not losing my mind. I have been recommending to you to everyone because people on the outside think that making movies is glamorous, but really it's a lot of stress, hard work, network, begging for money, helping other people's projects, rejection, celebration, finding community, and keeping at it because you have a passion for the art of storytelling. Your podcast captures all of that. So thank you. 5 stars. Thank you so much, MK Bryce. That really means a lot. You did really just kind of summarize the whole thing in a sentence or two.
That's very cool of you, MK. What does MK stand for? Tell us. Write us back. Tell us more. Give us more compliments. But no, thank you very much.
Mortal Kombat Bryce.
Yeah. Michael Corden Bryce.
I was going to say Michael Kors Bryce.
Michael Corden, our real name.
Yeah.
If you would have been like... Could be anyone. It could be any name. Michael, Marianne, Mistletoe. Let us know. Let us know.
Marianne Carruthers.
Bryce. Marianne Carruthers. Bryce. Ah, I'm in. I'm in for that one. Let's just call her Marianne from now on. If you want to be like Marianne Carruthers, you could send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you could leave us a review on iTunes. Check us. Well, like Marianne Carruthers. Marianne Carruthers didn't write us. She left a note. She left a review on iTunes. But you could be unlike Marianne and you can email us. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Check out the International Screenwriters Association. We like them a lot. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through the programs they offer. Head on over to networkisa.org to sign up for free. Thanks to Ashley Wessel for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening. Talk to you next week.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and my sci-fi horror...